I know certainly I was having some hiccups, gremlins in the works in my laptop this morning. Hopefully not too disruptive, but solved. Good, well, may we have a gremlin-free next couple of days. Lovely to see you back. And this afternoon, the plan is to visit the third of the guest houses, the third of the intensifiers, which is attentiveness. So I'll talk for a while about attentiveness, and then we'll follow on with a period of reflective meditation. And after that, there'll be an opportunity to break up into groups and bring up anything that has come up for you from this morning's input from Pranyanita or from this afternoon's talk on attentiveness. Anything you'd like to share from your experience during the meditation or any questions that you'd like to discuss. There's an opportunity there to do that. And we'll have a short plenary session after that, group session, where we any questions that come out of the groups we can address together. And following on from that, we'll see where we are time-wise. There might be an opportunity to do what's called a Buddha Nusati practice, which is a reflection, visualization, recollection of the Buddha. We'll just see how time is. It'd be nice to get that in. Yeah, we'll see how things go. So, attentiveness. It sounds like a very schooly word. I don't know. It takes me back to school. You know, pay attention. I see what I do when I do that. Pay attention. I think I've had that done to me a lot as a child. Pay attention. I wasn't the most attentive of children. Anyway, so we heard from Pranyanita this morning about engaging, that initial engagement with either an object or a practice whereby we set our heart on a particular object. We want to engage more with it. It attracts us. It gets our juices going. It stimulates us, and we want to be more. We want to engage more deeply, more intimately, if you like, with the object of the practice. And that leads that kind of emotional engagement leads on very naturally to resolve. So that sense of a conviction that this is good, we it fits in with our goals, our values, and we want to commit to it. We want to pursue it. But I'm sure you've had the experiences I've had that you know, I've committed to something, a project of some sort, and with time, that commitment wasn't enough. I don't know, maybe because it was based on enthusiasm rather than something deeper, or else maybe obstacles come along and that the momentum of the project is lost, and the commitment seems to be lost, and the commitment sort of just wanes. I'm sure that's a familiar experience with you. Certainly is for me. So attentiveness is, if you like, what happens when we run further with the resolve, when the resolve has the possibility, the chance, the circumstance, the conditions to flourish, to flower. What's the next step? What can resolve flower into? What is the fulfillment, if you like, of resolve? Where can that commitment go? And of course, it's important for tasks that require perseverance for their accomplishment. Yeah, any task. Indeed, it's essential to carry further, to carry the resolve further. So, for example, with meditation, you know, meditation is a long-term project, isn't it? We all know that. Very few people have the gift of just being able to sit, follow the instructions, and wow, they've got it. Most of us have to develop our capacity. Even before we get on the cushion, you know, we have to, that there are so many other competing resolves out there, aren't there? It could be, we want to learn Italian, we're so looking forward to lockdown finishing and just traveling, and we want to learn a language. Or I don't know, we've put on a bit of weight over lockdown perhaps, and we want to get fit. So that's another resolve that we have. Our It's coming into spring, the garden needs attending to. Yes, how wonderful. Another resolve. So, there are competing resolves with meditation. So just getting onto the cushion may not be that straightforward. But once we do, even if we do get onto the cushion, there are problems that need to be solved. There are conversations that need to be reviewed. There are scenes from the box set that I was watching last night. That episode is very strong, and the scenes are still going on in my head. Oh, that didn't quite make sense. So all of this is competing with my attention, my intention, for example, to attend to my breath. So again, we need, in order to be attentive, we need to develop a mental muscle, if you like. A capacity for sustained attention doesn't just happen. We need to develop it. It's like a muscle, you go to the gym and you work on it. It takes effort and practice, sustained practice. So we're talking about holding our mind to our practice in the face of distractions, as I've already described, those competing objects of emotional engagement, but also mental habits that we all perhaps have, habits of scattered attention. We live in an age when our attention is being grabbed by advertising and by digital technology. Apparently, the average attention span is decreasing. And it's not surprising, isn't it, with all these potential distractions calling on us. There's talk of the attention economy. People, it is a valuable resource, and people can make money out of attention or attention. So in the face of all these pressures, all these if almost lifestyle pressures, all that stimulation that is happening around us. We need to train our minds. There's another reason we need to do. Well, I certainly need to train my mind. So I don't know if you're like me. I think quite a few people might have this tendency towards abstraction. I think it's a certain type of mind, but I certainly have this type of mind. So rather than engaging with concrete sense experience, I'll very happily go off on into my head. I enjoy dwelling in my head. I'm very happy there. Whether it's playing chess, or I used to love maths when I was into it. I've probably forgotten most of it now. And all these sorts of activities, very analytical, they require concentration, but a particular sort of concentration. It's not the most integrating of concentrations in my experience. It's kind of a narrow band of consciousness. If you like, I certainly used to regard myself as a bit of a chess geek, so it's kind of a geek factor. So there's an ability to concentrate, but it's on a very microscopic area. Whereas, there's kind of a sense of all the attention is on that area, so there's a bit of an alienation from the broader picture, broader field. For example, with me, with chess, I think there was a bit of alienation from a broader emotional range, a broader range of emotional experience. And the an antidote, well, Buddhism has provided some bit of an antidote to me, in terms of just grounding in the body, like we've been doing this morning already. We've the practices like the body scan are just dropping into the senses, dropping down into the body, the mindfulness of breathing, focusing on the sensations associated with the breath. All of these are really wonderful antidotes to that abstract thinking. attending to the posture, that's something that's always available to us, isn't it? Certainly for me, when I get off a bit on a train of thought, coming back to the posture and just feeling my getting back to a sense of my body and its shape and it's the sensations. So we're looking at this capacity for sustained attention in the face of these mental habits, these distractions. And there is the word for this attentiveness, at least as we've translated into English as attentiveness, the word in Sanskrit is smriti, and in Pali it's sati. You might have heard of the Satipatthana Sutta. It's all about a practice of mindfulness of breathing, the Satipatthana Sutta. So sati or smriti is sometimes translated as attentiveness, but also can be translated as recollection. So it's a sense of remembering. And sometimes it's actually a sense of remembering not to forget. Because I think forgetting is a big part of getting distracted. Forgetting that our object of attention is the breath, for example. And, you know, sustained attention is not something we can attain through gritted teeth, through conscious willpower. And the reason is it's a subconscious process. It only happens when our sub-minds are focused in the same direction and with a common aim of attending. When there's this kind of broad harmony between our sub-minds that this is going to happen, is it going to happen? Otherwise, our sub-minds are all vying for various attentions and we just get distracted. So willpower is not enough. Willpower does not cut it when it comes to trying to have sustained attention on our breath or any object. What does cut it, what does register with our unconscious mind is, our minds, is intention. That's how we can access, if you like, and shape and influence our sub-minds, our unconscious minds, subconscious minds. So this is where the previous intensifier, resolve, is feeds into attentiveness. So resolve supports. I'll say a bit more about how it does this. I'll say more about intention generally and how actually intention comes out of resolve. So if we can put our effort into our intention, that will register with our subminds, and we will be able to develop that capacity to attend over a sustained period. So the effort we want to put in is not, as I say, gritted teeth to attend, but the effort goes into maintaining the intention to attend. I think it might seem subtle, but it's a really crucial distinction. So it's the intention, and maintaining the intention is where our effort needs to go into. I'll come back to intention. I think it is really crucial to this whole area, and I think it's a thread that comes through from the previous intensifier of resolve, and is very much there in attentiveness. This other word comes in to our capacity for sustained attention, and it's diligence. I quite like the word diligence. We hear a lot about due diligence these days, don't we? And I think part of diligence is making an effort to sustain our intention to attend. Another aspect of diligence is kind of, I think vigilance is probably the best word. So it's effort to notice distractions looming in peripheral awareness. And I'll say a bit more about peripheral awareness. and catching them, if you like, as they come over the hill, while they're still subtle, while they aren't too coarse and interfaces. Also, vigilance around the possibility of us judging our judgmental mind, that pay attention figure. So yeah, vigilance is an important aspect of sati, that ability to just to notice distractions coming over the horizon in our peripheral awareness. And again, I'll say more about peripheral awareness. But however much we are diligent, however much we have a strong intention, we're human, and intruding sensations will encroach on our meditation, won't they? So it might be aches. We have an aching knee or back, or it might be something beautiful like the bird song out there, or it might be something a bit more irritating like notifications on our computer coming through when we thought we had switched off notifications. Our thoughts, our emotions, whatever, all of these are potential intruding sensations. Buddhism sees thinking as a sense faculty. So it's important in the Buddhist tradition, and just from a practical point of view, not to push these away, not to push intruding sensations away. And but to hold them in peripheral awareness. So I said I'd come back to peripheral awareness. There's a visual metaphor here with peripheral awareness. Just as we have a peripheral, we have a focused vision, as I'm looking on each one of your little screens now, and there's the peripheral awareness, which is just on the outer range of my visual field. And now, if something were to suddenly dash across that peripheral awareness, I would notice it. I would pick it up. Even though I'm focused on you, I can see you. I can notice the detail on the screen. So similarly, our minds, our awareness has the possibility for attention on an object of focus and that peripheral awareness. And objects come into that peripheral awareness without necessarily engaging our attention, our full-on attention. So we can these intruding sensations that I'm talking about that come into our meditation, we don't have to hold them center stage. We can keep the breath center stage, but hold the intruding sensations in that peripheral awareness, just on the margins there. So a bit of an awareness of them, but not attending to them, but not pushing them away. I think that's the key thing. And there's a sense that this more complete experience, not pushing things away, it's accommodating those intruding experiences to some extent, at least in peripheral awareness, not blocking them, not cutting off from them. There's something more holistic about this experience. I suppose that image that Pranyanita mentioned earlier of the firmly rooted tree comes to mind. So it's like there's a resilience that comes from being able to hold the attention and the peripheral awareness at the same time. It's like the tree is able to sway in the very strong wind, and it's because it's able to give and accommodate the strong wind that it's not uprooted. Obviously, its strong rooting is crucial, but it gives way and doesn't snap. It's flexible enough. It's resilient. So I think, a good metaphor for this ability to hold the intruding objects, intruding experiences, intruding sensations in peripheral awareness while keeping our focus, our attention on the main object of concentration, the breath. No, my screen is doing funny things. It's going dim and disappearing, so I might lose sight of you any second, and then there'll be a little tapping of me trying to come back in. I hope it doesn't happen again. I thought I'd sorted that. So this is, it's kind of a holding action. This, the resilience that I'm talking about, of being able to use the peripheral awareness and attention, it's kind of a holding action because we can, for example, notice the Vedana associated with these intruding sensations or thoughts. So a thought comes in and it's, and we just notice, is it pleasant or unpleasant or neutral? An emotion might come in and we just notice, is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? And just the virtue of, by virtue of doing that, attending to the Vedana, the hedonic tone, it actually might, it's a holding action. It might stop us progressing on from the Vedana, sorry, from the sensation and the Vedana with its associated Vedana, into thought, into proliferation, into thinking, into interpretation. And see, interpretation just brings in the mind and the potential for just getting it completely wrong, going off on one, as we often do. Our stories, we bring in our stories, and we distort the sensation. Whereas if we can just keep it to the bare experience of the sensation and the Vedana associated with the Vedana, if so, it's the same thing as getting, bringing our awareness into the gap. And not progressing into all that fabrication and proliferation of thinking and likes and dislikes. Yeah, it is very much about bringing awareness into the gap in the meditation itself. I want to talk now, as I promised earlier I would, about intention, focusing a bit more on intention and levels of intention. Intention is kind of related to so many of the terms we've been using already. Purpose, intention is so bound up with purpose. The word is chetana in Buddhism, in Pali. And the Buddha placed so much emphasis on the centrality, importance of intention, of chetana. He said that chetana is action, you know, and it's fundamental to Buddhist ethics. Intentions is the intention behind what we do. We say if we give, and we give in order to become more popular. To gain social kudos, that's one act. If we give because people need that whatever we're giving, and it'll help them, and that's what is our, that's our intention. That's a very different act, and Buddhism recognizes that the intention is core to. It's not the only facet to ethics, but it's a core facet to ethics, and to how that action will affect us. And intention carries over. I think I mentioned this earlier. It carries over from our previous intensifier of resolve. Pranyanita described very beautifully how, you know, conviction, the two parts of resolve, or conviction initially. She talked about doing. She knows when she feels when she's done her kung fu and meditation double sit, and her partner Kasha Mitra knows when she's done it. You know, it's obvious. She is absolutely convinced of the results and the benefit of doing that, and out of that comes a commitment to do it, to doing it as often as possible. So with that, and part of an integral part of the commitment, I imagine, is a formulation of intention. Whenever I get the opportunity, when circumstances allow, I'm going to do my kung fu and double sit. Yeah, so it's a firm intention comes up at that point. But this intention doesn't stop there at resolve. It must carry through to attentiveness, as a kind of thread, because it's just an essential ingredient to it, to that staying power, with attentiveness, which is an integral part of attentiveness. The problem, of course, is forgetfulness. we need to constantly renew our intention. I went off a bit on a train of thought when Pranyanita was talking about mission. I know the sense she described of this room with all the maps and all the planning going on and a team chipping in. And my mind went to the 70s Mission Impossible series on TV. I don't know, I think before Tom Cruise, he was probably at school in those days. Anyway, it used to start off with Jim arriving in something like a telephone box to get his mission. And he'd find a tape recorder in the hidden in the corner in an envelope. And he'd open it up and there'd be a tape recorder, he'd press the button and it would say, should you decide to accept it? This is your mission, Jim. Should you decide to accept it? And it would describe kind of a mission, an impossible mission, with photographs and whatnot. And then towards the end, it would go on, it would say, should any of your IM force be caught or killed, the Secretariat will disavow any knowledge of your action. Good luck, Jim. This tape will self-destruct in 10 seconds. Funny how I can remember such useless stuff. Anyway, and then the tape would self-destruct. It would go up in steam and hiss. Why am I talking about this? Oh, yes. So, might seem a bizarre sort of metaphor, but yes, our intentions are a bit like a tape recorder sometimes, aren't they? They last 10 seconds and they go up in steam, up in smoke because of forgetfulness. So we need to come back again and again to our intention, to our mission. So, for example, in the mindfulness of breathing, what's our intention? Let's get it on the table first of all. We sit down, get it out there. Get out your intention. What's my intention? What do I want to do? Why am I going to spend this next 40 minutes sitting here? And rather than solving all my problems and the world's problems, why am I here going to do something different to that? This is valuable 40 minutes. So it could be to attend to the breath, to focus on any pleasant sensations that arise in association with the breath, to notice distractions, or forgetting of the intention as that happens, as soon as possible. That's a good part of the intention, as soon as possible. To intend to return to the breath with kindness. That's an intention. There's another intention, not to suppress those intruding sensations or experiences coming into peripheral awareness. So there's a string of intentions we can establish and lay out on the table as we begin our practice, in order to strengthen the intentions. That's the reason we're doing it, to remind ourselves this is what we want to do. So that they're all examples of kind of immediate intentions, but intention is more rich than this. And I'll just spend another couple of minutes talking about the different levels of intention. So that's the immediate set of intentions, perhaps, for example, the mindfulness of breathing. But there may be more medium-term goals or intentions in that, towards medium-term goals, like developing stable attention. So perhaps that's our intention for doing the mindfulness of breathing, is to develop stable attention, because we know that will change our acuity of perception, our ability to reflect, our mental states. So much can come out of, as you know, mindfulness training has very much got a whole body of experimental data or evidence, an evidence base to show the impact of developing your capacity for stable attention, you know, the effects it can have. So there may be the longer term intentions as well. So broader, longer term intentions that satisfy wider, broader goals and values. So what's the final intensifier? Pranya, wisdom. That can be our intention to get to that guest house, the final the guest house, the pranya. our awakening. Maybe that's our intention. That's our goal. So there's this other aspect of attentiveness, which is keeping these wider goals, these longer term goals in view. It's called continuity of purpose. It's one of the descriptions used for this aspect of attentiveness, keeping the longer term goals in mind. And it's often, so sati, I mentioned, was the Pali for attentiveness, or sometimes might described as mindfulness or recollection. But it's often paired with the word samprajana, which brings more of that sense of continuity of purpose. And it's really about remembering the overall picture. What's important? It's like, a broader aspect of the picture, a more strategic aspect of the picture is the ethical dimension, of course. So this samprajana has kind of a bit of a sense of being an ethical compass. How do our actions relate to our values, our for example, the precepts, the five precepts? This samprajana keeps the will in line with ethics. Keeps the will being that impulse towards or away from an experience or object. We went through that, didn't we, with the five constants. Anyway, and vigilance comes in here again. So I mentioned vigilance in terms of steering back to the object, avoiding those kind of distractions that are coming over the hill, and noticing them before, while they're still in peripheral awareness, before they grab the central focus of our attention. So vigilance is kind of this sentry. It's a protector. It sees things in the distance and alerts us. So similarly, an aspect of samprajana is in relation to the ethical dimension. There's a vigilance that notices the unskillful aspects of thoughts or emotions, and recognize them, bringing awareness to them means we can choose not to feed them. So again, vigilance is that sentry that changes our behavior. So we're this aspect, samprajana, this awareness of the wider context, brings an understanding of the wider goals to the front. And it places our practice in that broader context. So it allows us to evaluate our practice. You know, am I actually getting towards the goal, that longer term goal, through this practice? Is pranya really there on the horizon with this practice? So using this sailing metaphor, I've never sailed, but I imagine every now and again you have to go down into the cabin, get out your navigation kit, your GPS and your compass, and you have to find, well, am I going in the right direction? Where am I? And am I going in the right direction? Well, if you like, samprajana allows us to do this. It allows us to see where we are in relation to our practice and the goal. Where does it fall short? For example, you might identify weak points in your practice. You might see that your attentiveness is weak. So then you might say, okay, well, I'll develop my resolve in order to be able to feed into and support my attentiveness. Or it could be that you decide my practice isn't balanced. You know, I'm doing too much mindfulness of breathing, not enough metta bhavana. So my mindfulness is a bit cold and difficult because it's lacking in the emotional engagement. Okay, well, I think it's time to do some meditation. I'll stop talking about meditation. Let's do some meditation. So I invite you to take a meditation posture. We'll do about 20 minutes or so of reflection, and I'll drop in some points from the input that I've just laid out, focusing in on aspects of attentiveness. So finding that posture which gives you a stable, erect body, erect spine, comfortable. Anything coming strongly into your senses, any sounds or smells, residual tastes, maybe the most dominant sensation is that contact with the points of support from your chair or cushion or mat or floor. Maybe it's the temperature in the room. Maybe take three long, deep breaths. So let's set some intentions for this practice. We'll do a mindfulness of breathing. So the intentions, the natural intentions, are to attend to the breath. That's the basics, isn't that? To attend, to turn our attention to the breath and the physical sensations of the breath. A second intention might be to notice when distractions or forgetting happens as soon as possible. So we catch those distractions as soon as possible. Can you establish that as a strong intention? Kind of sending a message down to your subconscious minds. This is what I want to do. I want to catch those distractions, that forgetting, as soon as possible. And so important. Let's set a really strong intention to return to the breath when we do find ourselves distracted, to return to the breath with kindness, without judgment, with loving kindness towards ourselves. Another intention to slip in there is to renew. Each time that happens, each time I return to the breath, I'll do it with a renewal of my intention to attend to the breath. Just jogging my memory. Each time I return to the breath, I will renew my intention. And if you haven't got enough intentions already, here's another one. The final one is to not to suppress intruding sensations, but allow them to remain in peripheral awareness while you keep your main focus on the breath. Can you get some strength of intention behind that? Not suppressing intruding sensations, but allowing them to remain in peripheral awareness while keeping your focus on the breath. So having established quite a few intentions, having set quite a few intentions, let us progress to attending to the breath. I won't ring any bells apart from a final bell, and I'll drop in some reflections, some questions intermittently, while you continue to attend to the breath. So when I drop in these reflections, can you just hold them in your peripheral awareness while you continue to focus on the breath? So are you renewing your intention to attend to the breath every time you get distracted and return to the breath? How strong is your intention to be kind to yourself when you notice you're distracted? When your attention is firmly on the breath, to what extent can you notice other sensations, experiences, objects of awareness in your peripheral awareness? So what is your experience of peripheral awareness when you're attending to the breath? Can you hold intruding sensations in peripheral awareness, not pushing them away and not taking your attention away from the breath? So when intruding sensations do occur, can you focus in on the Vedana, the pleasantness or unpleasantness of those sensations, and hold back from thought proliferation, from interpretation? So I invite you now to let go of any effort involved in responding to those reflections or in attending to the breath. And just notice your experience, the flow of your experience, any sensations, thoughts, emotions. Let them arise, let them be, let them cease, let them flow. transition from the meditation in your own time. And we're going to break up into groups now, an opportunity to share any thoughts you have about the input from this morning or this afternoon on the intensifiers of emotional engagement, resolve, and attentiveness. Maybe exploring any areas of interest. And so, shall we come back in, say, 20 minutes to address together any questions that might come out of those breakout sessions? Welcome back, everyone. And we have an opportunity now to share anything from our groups or ask any questions. Feel free just to unmute and speak.
I have a request, Ratnadeva.
Sure, Julie.
Which was, I was saying in the group that because I haven't done many retreats and certainly none in physical real life, as it were, I'm not used to the ritual. And I felt very left out in that process. And I want, because it's new to me, I wanted to find a way into it. Mm-hmm. And it's partly just the way I learn. It would really help me if I'd had the words and translation so that I could follow it, so I kind of knew what we were about and what we were doing. And I actually Googled in the middle of it and found something that was a Tri Ratna something or other that was very useful. But if we're going to be doing any more ritual, it would be fabulous if just the words and translations could be made available.
Thank you, Julie. That's really useful.
Can I just say thank you for having breakout groups, because they're always so valuable, and I'm so pleased that you've got it built into your to your program.
Great, Velasani. Yes, I realized on this particular retreat, because we've conceived of it as more of a meditation retreat, we haven't done a huge number of breakout sessions, but at least we've got some in. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, you don't need a huge number, just a few is very nice.
I think particularly in the afternoon, because
yes,
be a bit soporific, can't it?
Yes, nap time is the afternoon.
One question I had, which I started in the group and then we were put back into the general platform.
Sure.
This morning we talked about the Dharma and how that connects potentially with the heart. I believe it was cited, this example of this free climber, which has all this negativity. But perhaps you can explain a little bit more, because Dharma is, what I understand, mostly connected to intention, and intention is more in the mind than the heart. No, I didn't quite understand that part.
That's an interesting question about intention. I mean, Dharma. My understanding of Dharma is just Dharma is such a big field. It's the whole teaching of the Buddha. But the translation for the word Dharma is, it goes on for columns and columns in any of the Pali or for Dhamma or the Sanskrit Dharma. You know, the columns go on and on and on for the different meanings to Dharma. So, but with that aside, your question, Richard, about intention, I think it's really useful to actually put these terms under the microscope. What do we mean by them? Flesh them out, investigate. See, there can be such rich concepts. So intention, I think, has certainly a cognitive thinking aspect to it. But what makes us come up with an intention, and what makes an intention a strong intention or a weak intention? Surely there's a heart component, a will component, a volitional component to I really want this. So you know, it's a strong intention. I think intention brings in, in my usage of and my understanding of the term, it brings in both understanding and wish and heart. So the cognitive and the volitional. So I don't have a sense of incongruity there with. Does that go anyway, Richard, to addressing your question?
Yeah, it's quite helpful. I think you make that connection to the heart, as into the drive, the will, which is a little bit different from the mind. I can see where you're coming from. Thank you.
I think I would probably add to that I think when I was talking about the climber, in Dharma life, it's a lot about us bringing the whole of ourselves into that process. And there are activities where it's okay to leave things out. And I think in relation to the climber, it was all right for him to leave emotions out, for example. You know, it still worked. He could still do the climbing and so on. But essentially, a part is left out. And I think with the Dharma life, really, as you practicing, you becoming more and more integrated. That's what's happening. All of yourself is becoming more unified and kind of gathered, if you like. So unless you bring all of yourself, which is, for example, the emotional aspects, you know, the heart is part of it, it's very difficult to get that integration.
I just wanted to ask about the intention and the volition and this idea of where that sits, but also just being very aware of this idea of attachment, you know, that we can become maybe overly attached to our intention or volition, or I wonder if that is, sometimes I feel like it's a fine line between intention and grasping, I didn't know whether either of you could speak to that.
That's a great question, Teresa, and that's such a crucial question. How easy it is for us to grab hold of goals in the spiritual life, just to shore up our beleaguered egos. So you know, if the ultimate intention is to go beyond and transcend ego, and I'll be talking a bit more about that. It's a bit clumsy language, but I'll be talking about that a bit more tomorrow when we go on to prana. But if in the attempt to transcend the ego, you just dig in the ego, even because you've got all these goals and attachments to fulfill certain intentions, I'm going to be able to, I don't know, meet my expectations in terms of the length of the periods I can meditate, or the depth of my concentration, or how long I can go without getting distracted. If you set up all these goals and get attached to those intentions, and yes, intentions and goals are they're all intermixed, they're all there in the mix. Potentially, you're just shoring up and reinforcing the ego. So you're actually not really keeping in mind the broader intention, the broader goal of the final goal of prana, of transcending the ego. So this is one of the paradoxes of the spiritual life. It's so easy to sabotage. It's so easy to get hold of the wrong end of the stick and undermine the task. If you lose sight of the primary, what's this? The prime directive in Star Trek, wasn't it? The prime directive is to go beyond, to boldly go beyond the ego. And that, again, it's clumsy language, but we'll look a bit more at that tomorrow. So yeah, great question, and we could spend a whole retreat really on this question of looking at goal orientation and attachment to goals, and on the one hand, or else just saying, hey, you've got everything you need. We touched on this in our group. You've got everything you need right now to be enlightened. Your consciousness is pure. Your awareness is actually pure. You are complete. I see we have got to about past, even the half past. So unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. But yes, I'll maybe just leave. It's not a bad note to leave on. We have everything we need. Yeah. In this moment, right here, right now.
Yeah, that's very true, Ratnadeva. We all have everything what we need. We don't need to search outside. And we need to have the faith. Faith in our practice, faith in Dharma. So, yeah, that is very important. And thank you very much for a beautiful talk. And I enjoy my meditation. There's 5 intentions. I was telling in my group that I really enjoy that. It's something happens when you have those intention, and that this everything coming, you know, arising and passing, and you are just with your breath, sitting with your breath and enjoying that moment given to you. So thank you very much.
Oh, well, thanks for that feedback, Kalpa. Good. So I wish you all a